Few people are as dedicated to teaching people how to cook as Christopher Kimball. He published the magazine Cooks Illustrated and co-founded the popular TV and radio show America's Test Kitchen.
And we cooked it with the butter until it starts to set. Put the top on, let it sit for a minute. Then we have to put it back on the heat for 20 seconds.
That's right.
Turn it out, use the napkin rolling technique. Have I left anything out
That's
here?
That's it.
Last year, he launched a new project, Milk Street. The Boston-based venture teaches cooking, publishes a magazine, and makes a TV show.
So, Chris, you can see our sauce is cooked down. It's been about 5 minutes, and the colors also changed to this deep, beautiful emerald green.
You know, I had a small pond in Vermont once that looked just like that. It was kind of stagnant, you know.
But did you taste it?
No, I didn't. Even the cows wouldn't drink out of it.
Milk Street is also going on a live tour, and my colleague Celeste Headley caught up with Chris Kimball last week.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. You know, I've always wondered, because I mean, I'm a kind of a fangirl. I probably have seen you for years and years and years and own every single thing, including Milk Street that you've published. What is the most you've ever had to make of a recipe? I mean, sometimes they describe, you guys have described making dozens of batches of things. What was the toughest?
Well, this would be at America's Test Kitchen. Years ago, we did a chocolate cake 130 times, I think.
Holy cow.
Which is insane. I mean, yeah. I'm now reformed. I'm like, I'm going to Recipe Testing Anonymous. Now, we will keep it down to 10 or 12 times probably now. And our philosophy now is that we spend a lot of time on the front end figuring out what we want to test and what's really important. So I've gotten away from the 100 tests, but you still have to make it more than 3 or 4 times.
Yeah, and a lot of that, when you talk about figuring out on the front end, does that mean you're sort of figuring out scientifically how it might work before you even crack open a bag of flour?
Well, I think what it means is you're very clear about what you're after before you get into the testing. Sometimes tests take a turn, you know, an unexpected turn, but you're very clear about what you want out of a recipe before you start. You know, it's like the old Vermont expression, if you don't know where you're going, you can take any road, it'll get you there, you know? So you want to be really careful where you're trying to head up. I think also, if you're trying to do recipes that people are familiar with, like a chocolate chip cookie or an apple pie or whatever, then, you know, you're trying to perfect it to get the best version of that thing. What we're doing now is very different, which is we're going around the world and trying to put together a sort of a new repertoire. So it's less a question of perfecting something people are already familiar with. We're introducing something new. So it's a little different in terms of what we're testing for.
Is there a particular either ingredient or type of recipe that you know is usually going to be problematic for a home cook? Like I would assume maybe dough, because it's so difficult
yes.
to keep the yeast at the right temperature and keep it alive, et cetera, et cetera. Is that the most tricky thing?
Pie dough probably is the hardest thing because you have to cut the fat into the flour just right and use just the right amount of liquid. And if it's too dry, it falls apart. If it's too wet, it turns out bakes up tough. Yes, dough. We just did a piece in the new issue on pizza dough. And it turns out the most important factor in pizza dough is the temperature of the dough before you shape it and bake it off. And if it's 75 degrees, it's malleable, it'll bubble up, it'll be chewy. If it's 65 degrees or 68 degrees, it won't be. So that's something that people don't realize is the temperature of the dough, not just how
while
much water is in it. No. Yeah, well, while it's rising too, because if it's going to be 65 degrees, it's going to take a long time to rise. But before you pre-shape it into the four balls, if you're making that kind of recipe, you can let it sit in the fridge for a day if you want to develop flavor. You don't have to. Then you let it rise. Yeah, you want it rise in a warm place. But before you actually start to shape the dough into a pizza, you want to make sure that dough is around 75 degrees. If it's too cool, it'll be hard to shape, and it won't bake up right. It won't bubble up. It'll be a little tough. So the texture and the flavor of it will be much better, and it's easier to work with. So temperature, it turns out, is the most important thing in pizza.
What keeps you in this business? I mean, essentially, for decades now, you have been teaching people, and the recipes are so precise that even somebody with almost no experience in the kitchen could successfully make your chocolate chip cookie, right? What keeps you doing that?
No one's ever asked me that before. That's a good question. What else am I going to do? I can't go rabbit hunting every day or grow potatoes. I love what I do. I mean, look, what a great business. I mean, you sit down, you have a kitchen, you have people testing recipes, you argue about recipes, you taste recipes, you do a TV show, you do a radio show. I mean, you do a magazine. It's just really fun. And I'd say in the last few years, what keeps me going now is I've completely changed how I cook. I mean, it's a totally different ball game. I cook a lot more than I have in years, and I'm back at the beginning of the learning curve, really.
So what has kind of gone wrong, I guess, in our kitchens across America? Because with all of this, the time-saving appliances we now have, all the different things that make it so much easier to cook now than, say, my grandmother did, why do so few people actually cook their own dinners?
A lot of reasons. It started in the 70s and 80s when women came into the marketplace in large numbers, as they should have, which meant there was fewer people at home. Two, the alternatives are there. There's Blue Apron, there's prepared foods at Whole Foods markets and other places. A lot of restaurants versus 20, 30 years ago. So you have lots of alternatives to cooking your own food. And I think the biggest problem was people viewed, and this goes back to the 19th century, the 1880s actually, people viewed cooking as a necessary evil to get food on the table. And when you view it as a chore, not a pleasure, you try to avoid it. What's happened in the last 10 or 15 years is I think we're redefining what cooking is. It's not a chore. It's actually pleasurable. And once you get to the point that you enjoy it, then it's something you'll do more of. But for all those reasons, it's just a different place than it was when Fanny Farmer wrote her cookbook in 1896, when there just weren't that many choices.
So how do you go about, when you go about writing a recipe down for other people? You know, I've read cookbooks that, for me, I'm just a cook. I'm not a chef. So when I sometimes read, say, Jamie Oliver, and he says, add a dash of whatever. And I'm like, I don't know what a dash is, which is one of the reasons that I loved America's Test Kitchen, why I really like Milk Street, because it tells me exactly how much. What decisions do you have to make when you're actually writing a recipe down for someone else to
That's
recreate?
A good question. Well, yeah, I've made my career based on the huge difference between how people actually cook at home and how people think people cook at home. It's a different world. People will leave out entire steps. They'll substitute ingredients wildly. My favorite was someone substituted shrimp for chicken once, in a recipe and came out tough, oddly enough. People do all sorts of crazy things. And I think in part because they don't want to follow a recipe. They want to improvise. They want to be artistic. And so they feel it's beneath them to do what the recipe says. And I always say, the first time you make a recipe, please follow it step by step. But if you've been doing this a long time, they're just things you know people are going to do. For example, they'll substitute one cut of meat for another. That happens all the time. Or they'll substitute chicken breast for chicken thighs, which completely changes everything. Or they may not have a particular kind of ingredient, so they'll put something else in. Or their oven's off 40 degrees or 50 degrees from what they think. And so if you say bake for 40 minutes, that's useless. What you do is say bake for 20 minutes, open the oven, turn it around, look at it, check it every 3 or 4 minutes after that. So there's some things that you see over time that reoccur, and you just want to make sure that people are paying attention to that.
And has that job changed? And I say that because in my grandmother's day, she could read cookbooks that didn't have a lot of instruction because she had been educated in the kitchen. I wasn't. Yeah. So they say, look for shiny sauce, and I don't know what shiny looks like. Does that mean you have to be more instructive?
Yes, it does. If you pick up the original Fanny Farmer, they have replica copies you can buy. If it's to make a pie pastry, she used three words: make a paste, period. Paste was a pie dough. That's all she said, because everyone knew how to do it because they made it 3 times a week. Now, if I were to describe how to make pie pastry, it would take me 300 or 400 words, because you have to talk about the butter and the Crisco and how cold it should be and how big the pieces should be, and how to describe how far to cut the fat into the flour using a food processor or using your hands. and what should the color of the flour look like, and what should it feel like, and how much water to add and how not to add too much. And yes, so you have to go into a lot more detail.
So tell me about a surprise that you had. You know, I have used for a long time the America Test Kitchen recipe that puts vodka in the pie crust to make dry and flaky, which is a revelation to me.
It's a great recipe.
Yeah. What kind of surprises have you had in the kitchen where you either added an ingredient or changed something that you would have never expected?
Well, at Milk Street, I've had to unlearn a lot of things I thought were true. For example, I don't use store-bought stock hardly at all, because if you cook a chicken or a piece of beef in water, you create your own stock. And that's a very French tradition, which really, there are times you use stock, but most of the time you don't need to. I don't saute meat, you know, before I make a stew or a soup, for example, because you have meat. I don't need to double down on the umami flavor. I want the other flavors to come through. Ottolenghi introduced me to this, which is using handfuls of herbs, right? Like 2 cups of cilantro or 2 cups of parsley or 1 cup of basil or dill, massive quantities of things like that, you know, spices. Most of the cooking in Northern Europe barely use spices. French cooking doesn't use spices hardly at all. Places in the Middle East will use 3 tablespoons of sumac, you know, or 2 tablespoons of cumin. I mean, so all the rules I grew up with, which are mostly English and French, some of that stuff still makes sense, but some of it doesn't. In other words, there are very different ways of thinking about what cooking is in different places in the world. And so I've had to sort of let that go, you know, sort of clear out my head and take a fresh look, because there are other ways of thinking, entirely different ways of thinking about what is cooking and what is food and what is dinner.
How different are these recipes? Well, let me put it another way. How much can somebody who just does not have the equipment that you have follow the recipes in Milk Street? Do you need a set of French sauté pans to be able to...
No. I mean, don't forget, most people in the world don't have much equipment. I mean, a lot of places in the world, they don't even have ovens in their kitchen, like Vietnam. You know, they just have stovetops. Or Thailand, same thing. They have a propane burner or two. So the French had more, you know, batterie de cuisine cookware than anybody. So if you go anywhere else in the world, you're dealing with much, you know, many fewer things and not expensive things. So no, 85% or 90% of the recipes in Milk Street don't call for things that are hard to find. We occasionally will, like sumac is a, it's a berry. It's was used as a lemon in the Middle East, really a sort of sour and fresh tasting. And there are recipes that where it's all about the sumac, so we'll call for that. But 85-90% of the time, these are things that you either have at home or can get easily in your local supermarket. So it's not about exotica. I mean, when I was learning to cook in the 60s and 70s, you know, there was ethnic cooking, a term I don't love. But it was about authentically preparing a dish from Oaxaca, you know, a mole sauce, and it took all day, and this and the other thing. But that's not what's going on now. Everyone's talking about home cooking, Tuesday night cooking. And so there's simplicity to all of this. And all cultures, you know, have the same approach. They're not going to spend all day cooking dinner on a Wednesday night. So simplicity is really at the core of all of this. And whereas French cooking, I think to a large extent, is not about sometimes, but is not about simplicity.
So what effects do you think has the changes in cooking habits had on greater society? I mean, you must have thought about this a bit, the connection, say, between the obesity epidemic and, fast food or not cooking at home. How has our either propensity to cook our own meals or not cook our meals affected our lives, the quality of our lives?
Well, the two separate things. There's the whole fast food phenomenon, which is terrible with adult onset diabetes and the sodas and everything else and supersize me. That's a problem. I think one reason I'm such a proselytizer for home cooking is it's very hard to make yourself sick cooking at home, you know. Because it's inherently healthier because you're cooking from scratch most of the time. I do think, though, that most of the world starts with big flavor ingredients, chilies, spices, herbs, ginger, scallions, fish sauce, soy sauce, etc. You can get big flavors at home now pretty easily, whereas that's not true in French cooking. French cooking starts with fairly mild flavors. ingredients and then over a period of time develops flavor. That can give people what they want. People want big flavor. They always have. And so that's why they go to fast food, right? It's full of fat. It's full of salt. It's full of big flavors. You can get that at home now without more time and effort because all the stuff's available and we're cooking differently. And everyone knows, you know, people go out to restaurants. They know people can go to a Tibetan restaurant in the middle of Pennsylvania, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, for example. So that gives me some hope that people can get what they really want fairly quickly and easily. You know, maybe that will offset to some degree this rush to fast foods that occurred in the 80s, 70s, 80s, and 90s.
So what do people see at the live show version of Milk Street, as opposed to watching the TV show?
I see me make a complete fool of myself, which, of course, is always entertaining, and I'm very good at that. I figured out a couple of years ago that a live event's about the audience and the person on the stage and interaction. So, you know, I'm not there to lecture anybody. I'm there to bring people up on stage to do a tasting or a cook-off or a quiz or have some fun, a lot of Q&A. You know, we're there. If anybody, you know, two people cook, you know, they have something in common. And so I have something in common with everybody who comes to the show. And we're just not there to have fun, you know. And I like to make fun of the audience, you know, some of the stupid things they do in the kitchen. And then they get to make fun of me. So that's what it is. It's that back and forth. And that's what makes a fun evening for me anyway.
That's Chris Kimball. He's cook, TV and radio personality, founder of Christopher Kimball's Milk Street, and he'll bring Milk Street live to the First Center for the Arts at Georgia Tech tonight at 7:30. Chris, thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.